You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat Satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirza Al-Waqifi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وما تكون في شأن وما تتلو وَمَا تَتْلُو مِنْهُ مِنْ قُرْآنٍ وَلَا تَعْمَلُونَ مِنْ عَمَلٍ إِلَّا كُنَّا عَلَيْكُمْ شُهُودًا وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Qur'an, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth, or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater, but it is in a clear book.
Good day to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio. Good to have you with us. It's 12 noon here in Tehran, and I'm your host for the next hour. We'll start this hour's programs with our news bulletin. that will be followed by Bookshelf. The program introduces authentic and reputable Islamic books that have been written or translated into English. And we round up this hour's programs with our radio productions feature. Stay with us for this hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
A reminder of our top stories. The leader of the Islamic Revolution says the Iranian nation defeated both the US and Israel in the 12-day war as they reached none of their objectives. Hamas condemns Israel's execution of two unarmed Palestinian men in the occupied West Bank, calling it part of the regime's systematic genocide against Palestinians. And a top EU official accuses the US of blackmailing trade talks by threatening to increase steel tariffs. The leader of the Islamic Revolution has dismissed rumors that Tehran has sent messages to Washington seeking dialogue, stressing that the United States is unworthy of Iran's cooperation. Ayatollah Khamenei recalled the 12-day imposed war on Iran in June, noting that the Iranian nation defeated both the US and Israel as they reached none of their objectives. The leader said the US and Israel had planned for a war that would incite the nation and pit them against the establishment, but to no avail. Regarding regional and international issues, the leader said wherever America has intervened, the outcome has been war, genocide, destruction and displacement. He said Israeli attacks on Lebanon, Syria, Gaza and the West Bank are all backed by the US, adding that the Tel Aviv regime would not be able to commit those crimes without Washington's support. Ayatollah Khamenei described the head of the Zionist regime as the most hated individual in the world. Journalist and political commentator Eric Wahlberg joined us earlier to comment on the standpoints announced by the leader of the Islamic Revolution. He believes that Iran was willing to negotiate, but the Trump administration sabotaged negotiations.
So but then Trump turned around and said no. So he plays back and forth. He'll say that he dangles this idea of negotiations, hoping that he can gain advantage that if Iran, for instance, in June, Iran did say that it was willing to negotiate. And then what he did was he sabotaged that immediately. So this is another case where he's hoping that Iran will show some weakness and then he can move in and attack again. So it's perfect. Hideous, this kind of negotiating tactic, but that's the way Trump operates. He likes to terrorize and then dangle negotiations and then go for the kill. So this is really high stakes gambling is what he is. That's where he made his money, casinos. That's money laundering in his casinos. So he knows all about gambling.
The Israeli forces continue to violate the ceasefire agreement with Hamas in the Gaza Strip, killing more civilians and preventing the entry of aid into the war-torn territory. According to the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, thousands of internally displaced Gazans are still living without safe shelter as the cold weather approaches. Hamas has strongly slammed cold-blooded execution of two unarmed Palestinian youth in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin by Israeli forces, calling for unified resistance against the regime. Hamas says killing two unarmed Palestinian youth reveals the criminal mentality of Israel and its disregard for Palestinian lives in defiance of all laws and humanitarian norms. The movement added that this is not an isolated incident, but part of a systematic genocide and a desperate attempt by Israel to implement its annexation plans. Hamas affirmed that resistance is the natural and legitimate response to the occupying regime's escalating crimes and aggression. It called on the international community to take swift action to stop these field executions, which have become an official policy of Israel and are carried out without accountability. The statement was issued after Israeli forces killed two young Palestinian men from point-blank range as they were leaving their house without posing any threat. The regime forces then abducted their bodies. The repression of the Palestine Solidarity Movement continues unceasingly 2 years after the launch of Al-Aqsa Flood Operation. United Kingdom assigned the Palestine Action Group as terrorist, and Austria is following suit. Several members of the Anti-Racist Solidarity Association, Dar al-Janoub, face similar terror charges for their activism. Our correspondent Dieter Heinisch reports from Vienna.
First came the media campaign, then the pressure from conservative politicians, threats against members and damage to their property. Now the Austrian state prepares terror charges against one of the most established anti-racist and anti-colonial organizations in the country, Dar al-Janoub. Among the accused is their current chairperson.
The situation was similar like the house raids against our association Dar al-Janoub in February. The house raids were supported by heavy force through the special unit Vega, and they came into my apartment and they confiscated laptops, telephones, documents from the association, and also private books, for example a book from the 1980s in German language from Rassan Kanafani.
Following the raids, the activist lost his job and is now facing several charges for his political support of Palestine and anti-colonial struggle in the global south.
The state prosecutor accused us of membership of a criminal organization, membership of terrorist organizations, and also the kind of we are people who force others to violent acts and terrorist acts.
The association had to close their premises due to the growing legal expenses. The activists face imprisonment of up to 10 years if charged. The Austrian government launched its crackdown on pro-Palestine protests and activists after October 7 in 2023. It imposed a ban on the first rally that was held after the state, but activists went ahead and held the rally, which resulted in the arrest of hundreds of them. Now, 2 years later, the court has announced its ruling on the legality of the ban.
The Constitutional Court has now ruled after 2 years that the ban on the demonstration was lawful. We will now appeal this decision to the European Court of Justice.
Legal experts say this harsh repression of the Palestine Solidarity Movement in the past 2 years increasingly undermines democratic rights throughout Europe.
Gerade auch das Strafrecht immer mehr
criminal law is increasingly becoming a system of thought crime. This means that people are being reported and convicted because they hold a particular political opinion that is deemed illegitimate by the authorities. And I consider this a very dangerous development.
The European Palestine Solidarity Movement has faced unprecedented repression and discrimination in the past 2 years. Germany and Hungary are among the most repressive states, but Austria is taking even one step further, equating opposition to the Gaza genocide with terrorism. Dieter Reinisch from Vienna.
The Vice President of the European Commission has lashed out at the United States, accusing Washington of blackmailing trade talks. Teresa Ribeiro made the rebuke after U.S. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick said Washington might ease steel and aluminium tariffs if the EU reconsidered its digital rules. Europe's antitrust chief pushed back hard, saying Washington is trying to strong-arm the EU into weakening its digital rulebook. She stressed that Europe's digital laws were in place for protecting its citizens and were not a bargaining chip for the US. Washington argues Europe's Digital Markets Act, or the DMA, unfairly targets American tech giants, while the EU says it creates fair competition. Tunisia's president summoned the European Union's ambassador Wednesday after the latter met with the leader of the country's powerful main trade union. The authorities viewed the meeting as interference in the country's internal affairs, rejecting the notion that such talks help promote diplomacy. Our correspondent Iskander Nawar has filed this report from Tunis.
Tunisia made the headlines on Wednesday after President Qais Saied summoned the European Union's ambassador to lodge an official protest against what he called the failure to respect diplomatic rules. A statement from the presidency provided no details on the alleged breach in protocol by the European Union envoy, but referred to the use of practices outside diplomatic customs, a reference to his recent meeting with Nourdine Taboubi, the leader of the North African country's main trade union. On Monday, Giuseppe Peroni, while meeting with Taboubi, commended the role of the Tunisian General Labor Union, UGTT, whose response called for the country's enhanced cooperation with the European Union. However, the revelation sparked criticism, with the Tunisian authorities calling it an interference in internal affairs. We believe that the President's invitation to the European Union ambassador and his request to respect diplomatic rules and international agreement reflects a commitment to national sovereignty, a principle that was violated in the past 10 years. These comes as Tunisia faces a long political crisis with the reduced role of parties and organizations. That has also increased the state's sensitivity toward any external actions. Also, the UGTT was part of the 2050 National Dialogue Accord and seen as an influential counterweight to Saied since he took the helm of power back in 2021, which the opposition described as a coup. The UGTT's ability to take on a larger political and union role depends on its strength and influence. Since 2011, it has been a key player in both politics and labor issues and an active partner in every government. President Saied has stressed that national sovereignty is a red line. Any political decision is in the hands of the government, and that relation with Europeans must be based on mutual respect without pressure. Many observers say Tunisia is open to cooperation with the European Union, but remains firm in protecting its political independence. However, the latest draw amid internal tensions and the challenges, the future of relations between Tunis and Brussels remain uncertain.
The European Union has been Tunisia's largest trading partner and TLA for decades. The two remains at odds over a number of issues, including migration and human rights since Saied came to power. The summoning of the European Union ambassador over the alleged interference in domestic affairs could sour the relation even further. Iskander Nawar from Tunisia.
Fresh allegations of discrimination against Muslims in India are fueling renewed concern over what rights groups describe as a growing pattern of intimidation and selective enforcement. From classroom punishments to property demolitions and police raids, recent incidents have intensified fears of deepening marginalization under the pretext of security and law enforcement. Munawwar Zaman has the story.
In recent weeks, incidents highlighting the ongoing treatment of Muslims in India have sparked debates, with many arguing the community is facing a deliberate and targeted prejudice and institutional barriers. Earlier this week in Maharashtra, three Muslim students were allegedly forced to bow down before an idol and perform sit-ups as a punishment for offering prayers in the classroom. The incident sparked widespread concerns and outrage among parents, stating their children were humiliated. In another disturbing incident, a 64-year-old Muslim cab driver was allegedly forced to chant Jai Shri Ram by two young men near the Taj Mahal.
Following the recent blast at the Red Fort in New Delhi, security agencies have initiated extensive investigations nationwide. Raids are being conducted at Muslim homes, organizations, institutions, and other religious sites. Rights groups have warned that this pattern of scrutiny could deepen the stigmatization of the Muslim community, raising concerns about potential for profiling under the guise of investigation and national security.
In Bareilly City, the two-story market owned by a Muslim was demolished by the authorities, claiming the structure to be illegal, while traders and locals there alleged the action was targeted for being involved in I Love Muhammad campaign. While no actions are taken against Hindu properties, Shazan is a small business owner from Uttar Pradesh. He says demolition of mosques, Muslim properties, homes and businesses is systematic targeting of a particular community.
Why are people facing arrests if they chant, I love Muhammad, and why are the remarks by cleric being hyped in media? The authorities and the media has mostly been silent to the right-wing groups who frequently resort to hate speeches and violence, threats and intimidation against Muslims. Isn't there a law for them?
A leading Muslim scholar, Maulana Arshad Madani, in his remarks has also accused the ruling party and its affiliates of preventing Muslims from rising to positions of authority and educational institutions.
This is a new trend in India for anyone who speaks, criticizes, protests, or talks about injustice Muslims face in today's India. Their properties are either razed to the ground or they face arrests without due process. The right-wing groups are spreading venom on social media and there is no action on that.
The ruling BJP has repeatedly stated that it doesn't discriminate based on religion and treats all citizens equally. However, critics and various reports suggest that the party's policies and actions have contributed to increased communal tensions and Islamophobia in India. Rights activists have also accused the ruling party of failing to address growing incidents of violence and hate campaigns against the Muslim community, which observers say is being further fueled by the notorious Indian media and unchecked social networking platforms. Munawar Zaman, Saharanpur, Uttar Pradesh.
We end this news bulletin. Thank you so much for staying with us.
Thank you. 7. Barometric pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to our dear listeners. Thank you for joining us today. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is The Bookshelf. I am Nasreen Sayed, and today we're going to be talking about a book about alchemy. Middle Game by Seanan Maguire is a modern fantasy that blends alchemy, metaphysics, and profound philosophical questions. It tells the story of twins Roger and Dodger, designed by a mysterious alchemist to embody the doctrine of ethos. Roger holds the power of words and knowledge, while Dodger embodies numbers and creation. Together, they are meant to wield unimaginable power, but the cost is high. From the beginning, the story explores how being engineered for greatness affects their identities. Roger struggles with the weight of knowledge, the responsibility to speak truths that can change the world, while Dodger wrestles with the power to shape reality itself. As they grow, they experience loss, isolation, and fear, which makes their bond even more crucial. It is their connection to each other, trust, empathy, and loyalty that anchors them as they face forces beyond comprehension. The narrative alternates between their perspectives, showing how their abilities shape not just what they can do, but who they become. As they navigate a world of shadowy conspiracies, cryptic mentors, and hidden agendas, they must confront questions about identity, free will, and morality. It's a story that keeps you on the edge of your seat, while also inviting you to consider the consequences of extraordinary power for themselves and for the world around them. At its heart, Middle Game explores themes of transformation, interconnectedness, and the tension between destiny and choice. Alchemy becomes a metaphor for the human desire to create, to understand, and to transcend limits. And amid all this cosmic intrigue, the bond between Roger and Dodger remains central, showing how human connection grounds even the most extraordinary individuals, and how love and loyalty can define the choices we make. Maguire's novel asks us to consider the very nature of reality. How much of life is determined by forces beyond our control? How do our choices define who we are? What responsibilities come with power, knowledge, or abilities far beyond the ordinary? Middle Game entertains, thrills, and provokes thought in equal measure, leaving readers both exhilarated and reflective. The book has been widely praised for its imaginative world-building, complex characters, and unique narrative structure. Critics note that it is more than a fantasy thriller. It is a philosophical exploration of alchemy, identity, and human potential. So, why should you read Middle Game? Because it blends adventure and reflection, asking questions about who we are and what we are capable of, and reminding us how human connection can anchor us, even when everything else seems designed to manipulate or control us. It challenges our understanding of morality, destiny, and the limits of power, while keeping you completely captivated. And in the end, Middle Game leaves us with a question we can all consider. If you had unimaginable power, how would you use it, and what would you be willing to risk to claim your own identity and your own destiny? After the break, we're going to read a part from the book.
IRIB English Radio.
The air is heavy with the crackle of electricity, with the taste of ozone and mercury and the burning tang of alkahest, the universal solvent which has a nasty tendency to consume everything in its path unless properly contained, making it a complicated process. Destroying it is even more difficult. Still, a few drops of the thing can go a long way towards making the supposedly impossible happen. Even death, it seems, can be dissolved. The woman who calls herself Asphodel walks a slow circle around the table, studying her handiwork for flaws. She finds none, but still she circles restless as a shark, unwilling to commit to the final stages of her task, until she's certain. Certainty is a requirement of her profession, a bone-deep, rock-solid certainty that her will is strong enough and her desires are clear enough to remake the world in her own image. She isn't the greatest alchemist of her age, but she's going to be. There is absolutely no question in her mind of that. If she has to drag those fools in the Congress kicking and screaming into the bright and beautiful future she can see unfolding ahead of her, she will do it. And she won't be sorry. If they didn't want to follow her, they should have had the sense to get the hell out of her way. Asphodel Baker is 21 years old, 13 years away from the publication of the book that will cement her legacy in the hearts and minds of children everywhere, 23 years away from her disappearance and death. And she can no more conceive of failure than a butterfly can conceive of calculus. She's going to change the world, remake it in a better image than the one it's made in now. And no one's going to stop her, not her parents and not her teachers, and certainly not the All-Chemical Congress. She was a gifted student. No one who's met her, who's seen what she can do, would deny that. The denial of her mastery is nothing but short-sightedness and spite. The old guard, refusing to see the bright and brilliant future rushing up behind them like a steam engine roaring down its track. This is her time. This is her place. This is her chance to show them all. Asphodel stops circling and reaches for the bowl she has prepared.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Reed hasn't felt this good in years. Lee is safely back at the compound, up to her elbows in small-minded fools who can hopefully be more use in death than they were in life. The three sets of cuckoos have been split up and whisked away to their new homes to be raised by ordinary people in an ordinary world. The fact that three of those supposedly ordinary families belong to him, body and soul, is irrelevant. They are failed alchemists, all scholars who had the desire but not the skill to serve him more directly. They will play at being lovers. Perhaps some of them will actually fall in love, and they will raise his experiments with dedication and care. They are scientists. They've been given a project to complete. Failure is not an option. It would result in their bodies being given over to Lee's tender mercies, and no one who has met the woman would ever take such a risk. They are almost there. The impossible city will be his. The car stops. Reed adjusts the collar of his shirt before he opens the door. Gone are the jewel tones and eye-catching runes, replaced by proper funeral black and a high-buttoned shirt that lends an almost parochial tone to his appearance. The Congress is not susceptible to the same. A universal solvent has endless applications when properly controlled. When she's done, she steps back and considers her handiwork. So much of her plan depends on this piece being perfect. But what is perfection, really, if not the act of winning? So long as he can carry her to victory, he'll be perfect, no matter what his flaws. "You will rise against me, my beautiful boy," she says in a voice like honey and hemlock intertwined. "You will throw me down and swear you saw my bones. You will take my crown and my throne and carry my work into the new century. And you will never look back to see what follows in your wake. You will be my good right hand and my sinister left. And when you fall in finishing my design, you will die without complaint. You will do what I cannot, for your hand will never waver and your mind will never sway. You will love me and you will hate me and you will prove me right. Above all else, you will prove me right." She puts down the bowl and picks up the vial filled with liquid. Starlight with mother of pearl that dances and shines against the glass. She raises it to his lips and pours a single drop between them. The man she's assembled out of the dead gasps open his eyes and stares at her with a fearful wonder. "Who are you?" he asks. "Asphodel," she says. "I am your teacher." "Who am I?" he asks. She smiles. "Your name is James," she says. "You are the beginning of my greatest work. Welcome. We have so much to do." He sits up, still staring at her. "But I don't know what the work is." "Don't worry. Her smile is the first brick in what she will one day call the improbable road." We've been reading from the book The Middle Game by Seanan Maguire. And you are listening to The Bookshelf at IRIB English Radio. And I am your host, Nasreen Sayed. Have a wonderful day.
Join us in this journey.
this is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Have you ever wished you were able to check your blood pressure, heart rate, oxygen level, weight, and your overall health all within minutes without the need of making a doctor's appointment, waiting in line, or spending hours in a clinic? Well, the good news is that in Iran, South Khorasan province, there's a local company that has made a device that does exactly that, a health monitoring kiosk. Designed to be installed in cities, offices, gyms, and even residential towers. Its goal, to help make health monitoring quick, simple, and accessible for everyone. So stay with us as we take a closer look.
The idea of remote health monitoring isn't new. It has been evolving for years across the world. Known internationally as remote patient monitoring, or RPM, in countries like the United States, Canada, Germany, Sweden, South Korea, and Australia, digital technology has made it possible for patients to track their health data without ever stepping into a hospital. Smart devices like fitness bands, digital blood pressure monitors, or public health stations record vital signs such as blood sugar and heart rate. In more advanced systems, data is sent directly to doctors through secure software or mobile apps. Some countries even use artificial intelligence to process this information. Algorithms that can detect irregularities and alert patients or physicians instantly. And in many cases, a patient can consult with a doctor online through video or chat and even receive a prescription. In countries like Australia, where long distances separate people from medical centers, remote health monitoring has become essential. In Iran, interest in this field grew significantly after the COVID-19 pandemic. Among the pioneers is a company called Doramit, founded in 2019 at the height of the crisis.
South Khorasan province, due to its vast area and small population, is one of the least densely populated provinces in the country. This is because access to health services and medical care, especially in remote areas of the province, to be challenging. In this regard, one of the solutions that my team and I, as a specialized biomedical engineering team, came up with was to develop a kiosk that could be deployed in various remote locations across South Khorasan province. This kiosk would help collect medical data and process it using artificial intelligence, thereby addressing the shortage of doctors in the province. Thankfully, by installing these kiosks throughout the province, we have helped promote equity in the healthcare sector.
The company's first products entered the market in 2022, the actual health kiosk. How it works is that the patient stands in front of the device and the operator, while maintaining privacy and security issues, checks for the vital signs and the general health status of the patient. It's also possible to have a video consultation with a physician, which is connected online, and which would actually review the results. Also, you can receive a digital prescription from the physician. Obviously, this becomes very important in rural and small towns where the doctors aren't always available. to have a more detailed explanation about the function and the application of the device. Let's see what Dr. Golru has to say.
The health monitoring kiosk, armed, has the capability to collect patient data using wearable medical gadgets. Afterwards, through a design platform within the armed system, it can analyze the medical data using artificial intelligence. For example, regarding blood pressure, the system determines which range the individual's blood pressure falls into and whether they're at risk due to their blood pressure levels. It also displays a chart of the individual's blood pressure fluctuations over weekly, monthly, and yearly time periods. Regarding ECG, the individual can view all previous ECGs taken by the system and review the reports generated by the AI, which provide a complete overview of their health data. This helps the individual actually enhance their health level. Finally, the specialized AI in this system recommends a comprehensive dietary plan and an exercise program to improve the individual's health, which can help elevate the overall health level of the visitor.
This company is currently the only producer of health monitoring kiosks in Iran, a patented design with no identical model, either locally or internationally. But why build such a system? The answer lies in modern life itself. Air pollution, poor diet, and the growing number of people living with chronic conditions like diabetes, hypertension, heart failure, and respiratory disease have made quick and regular health checks a necessity. Remote monitoring can reduce unnecessary hospital visits, lower healthcare costs, and improve patients' quality of life by detecting issues before they become emergencies. And for people in remote areas where access to medical care can be limited, this technology can make a world of difference.
Our company's annual production capacity for the kiosks ranges from 500 to 1,000 units per year. Of course, these devices are customized for clients based on the specific applications of the kiosk, whether in the health, medical, or sports sectors, and are tailored to their deployment location. The system is customized to ensure it is functionally suitable for the specific purpose and location where it is installed. One important point is that we must drive the research and development for this product in a way that aligns with customer needs. It's fair to say that since the beginning of this product's production, we have introduced 14 new versions, both in hardware and software, which have been based on advancements in artificial intelligence.
The company's production team consists of 18 people, supported by 12 others in marketing and logistics, alongside 20 other individuals in the company's medical division. Each kiosk is made up of two main parts: the hardware, which is the metal structure and medical sensors, and the software, which uses artificial intelligence to analyze and interpret the collected data. At the final stage, each device undergoes a one-month quality control process before being packaged for installation.
One of the most important advantages of the health monitoring kiosks produced by our company is that they enable the creation of IT systems or electronic health records in the form of a health file for each user. Certainly, deploying these kiosks in more public environments and within organizations helps create larger data sets and bigger data collections, which ultimately enhances the quality of artificial intelligence and AI-based diagnostics. To develop more comprehensive systems for the AI and health sectors in the future, we need to have stronger and larger data centers. The deployment and eventual expansion of our kiosks across the country will undoubtedly contribute to building larger data centers for the advancement of artificial intelligence in the healthcare sector.
Today, 38 kiosks are active across the country and are installed in places such as oil platforms, government offices, and municipalities, serving hundreds of people every single day.
One of the most important points in the field of telemedicine is that the implementation of telemedicine-based systems reduces healthcare costs. This happens because there's no need to establish hospitals in remote areas to provide medical services. By using telemedicine kiosks, data can be collected, transmitted, and processed, helping us overcome the challenge of not having physicians available in those regions. However, when it comes to foreign models and related technologies, one of the major issues in the field of modern medical technologies is that many of these devices are imported and may impose very high costs on the healthcare system. By localizing these devices in our country, we have developed a system that provides all the required services at nearly one-tenth the cost of foreign models, while offering even greater capabilities. This truly eliminates the need to import similar farm products. The complete design of these devices has been carried out within our company, and the research and development efforts have helped us achieve a reliable system for telehealth. This has made us self-sufficient and removed the need to import expensive foreign alternatives.
These health kiosks are more than just machines. They're a bridge between people and healthcare. Step-by-step innovations like this are shaping a healthier, more connected, and more equitable future. This brings us to the end of this section. Thank you from the whole team. Hope to see you next time. Take care.
Forever love, our prophet.
Forever,
forever
love.
Good day to all of our listeners from around the world. This is Iran Radio broadcasting from Tehran, and I'm your presenter for the next hour. We start off this hour's programs with Middle East Stream. The program analyzes the latest developments in occupied Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria. And we round up this hour's programs with insights into the Holy Quran. The program presents a short exegesis and explanation of the ayahs of the Holy Quran. And we round up this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. Stay with us for the next hour.
Midstream.
Here we go again. Trump rolls out the red carpet, lights the chandeliers, flies F-16s and F-35s over the lawn, and welcomes Mohammed bin Salman to Washington like he's the headlining act of some geopolitical Vegas show. The big pitch? New Middle East, baby. But spoiler alert, it's mostly repackaged leftovers. Let's unpack this spectacle. Trump hails Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as a friend, and calls him a man of leadership, conveniently sidestepping the 2018 Khashoggi affair. You know, the one U.S. intelligence pinned on Mohammed bin Salman. When a reporter asks, Trump shrugs. Things happen. Chill, guys, just a little journalist murder. What could go wrong? Now, if this were just another photo op, fine. But no, they paired it with a multi-billion dollar investment promise. Mohammed bin Salman pledges up to $1 trillion U.S. dollars in U.S. AI, nuclear, and infrastructure spending. Trump beams. The optics? Saudi cash flowing into the U.S. Mohammed bin Salman rebranding as some peace broker. Everyone's making money, but the substance a lot murkier. Here's where the new Middle East narrative starts to crack. Trump is dangling 48 F-35 stealth jets in front of Saudi Arabia. Yes, the same jets that Zionist Israel has long used to claim its qualitative military edge. Suddenly, that edge looks a bit shakier, at least in rhetoric. But here's the kicker. While Trump is bragging that Saudi Arabia will get top-of-the-line F-35s, there's serious concern inside U.S. circles about how much of that cutting-edge tech Riyadh will actually be allowed to use. In short, they might buy the toy, but they probably won't be allowed to play with all the buttons. And yes, that qualitative edge for Zionist Israel probably won't vanish overnight. Meanwhile, what's Mohammed bin Salman doing? Oh, just playing the long game. He nods politely to Trump's Abraham Accords, but then publicly demands a clear path to a Palestinian state before he signs on. Translation, don't expect a magical normalization anytime soon, at least not without cover for the Palestinian issue, or so we think. Bottom line, the new Middle East isn't a transformation, it's a remix. Some old transactional alliances dressed up in shiny F-35 wings and trillion-dollar pledges. Trump wants a foreign policy win. Mohammed bin Salman wants legitimacy and leverage. But the myth they're peddling, it may look new, but the tune is familiar, and the strings are still being pulled in exactly the same way. I'm Ahwal Osman. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman arrived last week in Washington with trillion-dollar promises and a manufactured aura of strength, only to play supporting actor in Trump's desperate quest for a foreign policy win. Today, we unpack how the stage-managed new Middle East reveals more humiliation than influence for Mohammed bin Salman and far more chaos than strategy for the region. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ali Murad, political commentator and writer for Al Akhbar Lebanese Daily. It's a pleasure having you with us, Mr. Murad. Now, Mohammed bin Salman walked into the White House projecting power, yet Trump treated him as a financial asset rather than a strategic partner for the U.S. How does this dynamic expose the imbalance in their relationship And what does it say about Saudi Arabia's actual leverage in Washington?
Well, first of all, the relations between the United States and Saudi Arabia historically has always been based on the idea that the Americans protect the Saudi monarch and the rule of the royal family in Riyadh in exchange for oil for about 60, 65 years. But now this rule has been changed. It looks like since what we have seen so far since the first term of Donald Trump, that the United States is like offering the protection to Saudi Arabia in exchange for money. Because every time Donald Trump and MBS meet, they talk about investments, pouring more Saudi money into the United States. In the first term, he used to talk about tens and hundreds of billions of dollars. Now he's talking about trillions and trillions of dollars pouring into the United States from Saudi Arabia. So Donald Trump actually is exposing the reality of the relations between the Saudi rulers and the United States. It has always been based on protection. There's always a need by the Saudi ruler for the U.S. protection because he believes he is always in need for this protection to save him from possible internal foes and also from the regional competitors with Saudi Arabia. And it's not something specific for the Saudis. It's the same for other Gulf countries because they feel vulnerable and they always need protection.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Ali, Trump really just dangled the F-35 deal as a grand gesture to Mohammed bin Salman, but with severe usage restrictions and Zionist Israel's qualitative it's still protected by the U.S. How does this reflect Mohammed bin Salman's public attempt to maybe flaunt military power while privately really accepting terms that undermine Saudi sovereignty? How's that even possible?
Well, it's actually ironic because MBS is trying to show that he is projecting power in the region and he is, the number one military force in the Arab world. While if you take a look to what he talked about with Donald Trump and the issue regarding the F-35 deal, I think, first of all, we have to take into consideration that the Emiratis, they asked Donald Trump to accept the deal that they have F-35s in 2020 when they signed the normalization deal with the Zionist entity. So it's normal and natural that MBS would go to the Americans and ask to have the F-35s. But if you take a look to what the restrictions the Americans are and the conditions they are putting on the Saudis, you would conclude easily that it's actually has not